Thank you. So, hello everybody. In this talk I'm going to discuss a visual ethnography of general purpose police dog training. And this is one of five case studies of dog training cultures that we, my two colleagues at the back and Mara Mel, who's not here today. So it's part of a project funded by Levi Hume entitled Shaping Interspecies Connectedness. So I aim to demonstrate that dog handlers and police dogs enter into a form of becoming with through the tightly constructed management of the emotions in dog-human training relations. And this will be presented through visual images of the felt experience of the general purpose police dog handler training. And firstly, I'm going to just give some background and situate visual multi-species ethnography. Then I'm going to introduce our research subjects and the case study. And then I'm going to provide an exploration of the bite training specifically, followed by a more general discussion of the materiality of training. So there's now an emerging literature on multi-species ethnographies that try to address the experience of non-human animals involved in practices such as work, sport, farming, research, etc. However, the current literature is, there's a clear division generally between social scientists who tend to focus on humans, the human experience, and animal scientists who are more interested in focusing on the animal experience. And so there's a sort of paucity of methods for understanding how human-animal relations occur from a relational perspective. And there have been calls from animal studies scholars for methods better able to attend to these relationships, such as Van Doren and Coetzee and Helmrich and Buller as well. And to bring for sociology and humanities to try and bring the animal into the research. So within animal studies and among multi-species scholars, it's argued that visual methods are well placed to provide a means of investigating the embodied communication between humans and the more than human world. And the reasons for this are fairly obvious, in that animals do not speak or write in human language and it's quite hard to know what they're thinking. And furthermore, visual methods are able to capture and portray the world through attending differently to our sensory registers. So in this paper, we're going to take a naturalistic ethnographic approach in that the data was made by following the subjects using very minimal camera movements and a few close-up shots. And this method did not produce a direct mirror of the experience, but was rather a copy that held traces of the experience. But this necessarily becomes its own object and actor in the overall research. So our aim was to explore the potential of visual data to foreground the human-dog relation through investigating and portraying moments of interaction, including the materiality of the interplay between bodies, tools, equipment, space, and time. So thus, we aim to capture our research subjects' involvement with the training, atmosphere, and environment. But overall, in the research project, we use a range of methods. So we use observations in situ, shadowing, one-to-one interviews, photo diaries, and videos. But the videos were shot primarily around the formula for quality of behaviour assessment, which I think Maria mentioned in the first talk. So the idea from the whole project perspective is to try and have different methods that are more or less aiming at different sort of, have different strengths in relation to humans and animals, but that the visual is a way of exploring really how methods might address the overall relation. So in this talk I'm not trying to do animal behaviorism and talk about what the dog is experiencing, and I'm not trying to talk about what the human, I'm trying to give a more of a sort of relational perspective. So I'm now going to talk about the actual case study. You have to forgive the strange human heads.
Mm-hmm.
So the work that the dog patrol units carry out requires that they learn an extreme form of control, which relies on establishing an intensely intimate bond between dog and handler. And we argue that in contemporary police dog training in the UK, this bond is largely constructed through play routines and by ensuring that the dogs are having fun. This presentation will draw on a group which incorporated one experienced trainer, one trainee trainer, and four teams of handler dog partners who trained together for 13 weeks. So the trainee general purpose police dogs, GP dogs for short, were partnered with trainee dog handlers, and so in fact it was really human and dog training. So the aims were to teach the handler to communicate with their canine partner and for the dog to learn to follow the directions of the handler. And they need to build skills to a palette of learnt tasks, and the handler and the dog must form a bond. So the police dog dyad bridges the work, bridges both work and domestic relationship, and they often, after the dog's retired, the dog will often remain with the police person. So the role of a general purpose police dog is to chase and apprehend subjects or those deemed to be a threat to others or themselves, and they're trained to defend their handler from attack. And they're also used in atmospheric crowd control, such as at football matches. So both the dogs and the handlers need to have a high ball drive. That means that they need to enjoy playing together. And if they were the type of dog or the type of human who would lose stamina or get bored, then they would not be recruited or they would be dropped from the program. This requirement has been commented on by plenty of dog trainers and theorists, such as Vicky Hearn and Haraway, who both argued that the dog needs to want to play, and so does the human. So the training sessions centre around developing key abilities such as scenting, tracking, biting and obedience. And variants of these activities are practised in differing spaces such as disused buildings, airfields and farmland. Thus the dogs experience a full range of spaces and materials, surfaces and atmosphere that to a degree mirror their planned future workspaces. Training was portrayed as an experience of play for the dogs entwined with the concept of having fun. Thanks. Trainers reasoned that having fun supports the development of the bond essential for police work. And one trainer explained that for the dog, enjoyment encompassed the work, but also receiving the reward of praise expressed vocally and through touch. Taylor and Hamilton argue that touching animals is important in order to sense how they are feeling, and Don Haraway stated that my premise is that touch ramifies and shapes accountability. The accountability in the training is required across both partners in that both must develop the bond. The underlying training philosophy was described to us by the trainers as a combination of ethological understandings of the dog as a pack animal who responds to attack and defence drives. This was combined with positive reinforcement training used to shape the dog's natural instincts into controlled skills for police work. Positive training was seen as dog-centric, and because it allows a two-way communication between the species and offers the dog empowerment and choice, although in reality the dog's choices are always limited by human control. The trainer and the handlers believe that the dog would want to carry out the work for them, motivated by gaining enjoyment from the tasks and affirming their belonging in the handler pack. Okay, so I'm now going to move on to talking about the bite. I'll just have some water. So the police training utilises actions that dogs, the police believe, like to do, such as biting, and shape them into forms of police work. And the game of biting shifts into a serious business of actually apprehending people known or suspected of being dangerous. And these images demonstrate how the dog is trained to bite a running suspect. So before the dog is unleashed, the officer shouts a warning: police dog handler, make yourself known or I'll send the dog. Final warning, I will send the dog. and the dog learns to recognise the sound of that warning. And as the officer shouts, the dog begins to really start pulling on the lead, eager to get off and go into the chase. And after the officer has shouted the warning, the dog is knows that it will then be released and will run into the bite. So the dog straight away runs fast. Often they may have their ears pinned straight back, making a direct beeline into the suspect. And the dogs are trained to bite into the sleeve, a padded slip-on protector. And to hold the bite, ideally below the elbow, rather than make several bites along the body. And they're taught to make one good solid bite, which can give a strong hold on the suspect. In order to teach this, the handler or trainer, being bitten, will twist and turn their body while the dog grips on. So in one slide, in the first dog, he's not got quite a good enough bite, whereas in the second slide, you can see the dog's got a really strong hold. So once the dog's kind of twisted around a bit, then at that point the handler will call the dog off, ideally, and they'll engage in some tactile ball contact and verbal and physical touch. So the training tasks are explained as structured games in comparison to free play of rewards, but they're still described as games. And after successful completion, the reward is a short spurt of free play with balls, perhaps maybe two. This type of play is what Christoph Konecki defines as a joint action. And he states, that kicking the ball, catching the ball, the request to return the ball, fetching the ball, and leaving it forms the complete association called ball playing. The mutual adjustment of interactional partners through repetitive exchange of gestures develops joint actions, which in this case we can call association of play. Though from the outside the play might seem uninteresting because of the numerous repetitions for the participants, it is attractive and involving, and is confirmed by the reactions of the human, who might laugh, and the dog, who becomes active and engrossed. So Konecki describes repetition as a necessary part of play, arguing that if a stick is thrown once and returned once, then it's not a game, and only becomes so once it's repeated, in ways that both parties become to know their gestures as a form of routine. And it is this act of knowing that defines it as a game. And the joint actions between dog and handler are repeated over and over, with sharing knowing of each other's body moves and meaning, and in this is way the bond is formed. One handler told us that for the dogs, when they're actually working, the activity of catching a real human is far more exciting and enjoyable than this bite training and catching balls. And they said that you can't replace the active duty, because in the active duty, the dog is enabled to be the most dog version of a dog, even though it's still a highly controlled environment. So the game of training paves the way for sort of very real biting. And during police dog training, the dogs are taken to the very edge of play, and in the action of the police work, it sort of tips into real bites once they're in action. So the police are fine-tuning the dog's emotions and behaviour through micro shifts in the joint actions of the games, switching between actual fight moves and play, where there's a constant movement between seriousness and play throughout the bite training, and the dogs have to learn through this game how to cope with later serious situations. So these actions are in part choreographed through connections with place and the materiality of the training objects. The dog begins the training session in her metal crate and then walks on her leather leash, and then she hears and feels the sound of the warning from the handler, who's holding her taut while she's straining, and then she's released into the run and the bite of the padded sleeve, and then eventually she exchanges that for the plastic and rope toy. So the details of all of these different tools become attached into part of the sort of system of the game and how she understands what she's doing. I've just been shown 5 minutes, so okay. So the dogs are trained. I'm just going to move on actually to talk about the atmosphere of training. So the dogs are trained to search as well as for humans as well as objects. And these images show something of the atmosphere of training, which is conveyed through the image of the handler and the trainer walking down the woody track. And they're at ease, they're chatting, they're enjoying the outdoors. And Lola, the dog, is taught to crisscross in front and double back every few metres. So the dog periodically returns and the handler moves his arm to guide the dog on. So the handler and Lola remain in a joint action and a form of embodied communication. So in these images we see the human and animal bodies performatively in relation to the material space, with each body engaged and sensing the environment. And with video stills such as this, as Sarah Pink argues, you're not directly capturing the atmosphere, but you're sort of invoking it. She says, video cannot capture atmospheres, but it can be used to invoke our imaginative capacities to engage with the experiential dimensions of other people's worlds. So both as ethnographers researching in the middle of it and as viewers, we are invited to imagine being there. So the images record the materiality of training in ways that include the non-human and also the non-dog actors in the making of the training environment. And the handlers use their bodies to create the search space as the dog learns to remain in front and only move forwards across the search area. And obviously the dogs are scenting here. And as Alexandra Horowitz says, dogs see with their noses, and Lola appears to enjoy scenting for the human scent that she's been trained for, but she's scenting specifically for a scent that she's been asked to scent for. So it's not like a sort of free scenting overall experience, although we don't actually know what other smells she's feeling. So we're frequently told that dogs wouldn't do it if they didn't want to. The next images show the way that they're kind of taught through these very repeating routines, and that this navigating is communicated through arm movements and overall attunement with the body. So the training is a matter of communication between species as a form of two-way communication. And this is what happens when the dog doesn't want to do what she's asked. Here she's been asked to give the ball, but she doesn't want to. So the handler, he stops the game. He basically turns his body away. And then she comes and she's kind of like, well, okay. So I think I'm out of time.
We've got about a minute and a half.
Okay. So one trainer considered that the dogs experience a sense of achievement, which is reaffirmed by play and touch. So we often saw dogs carrying either the bite sleeve or toys back to the van at the end of a training session, and the trainer said to me that he sort of saw it as a kind of a sort of reward that they were the ones carrying it back to the van, and so the balls are seen as fun, but only in relation to the game. And once the game's over and once they're in the van, they're not desperate for the ball or desperate for the bite sleeve, which is about the context and what the currency of those objects come to symbolise in terms of their two-way communication. I guess it's just fundamentally the idea of a sort of highly, highly controlled form of interspecies becoming with. And I'm going to leave it there.